Hello and welcome to the Overland Journal podcast. I'm your host, Scott Brady, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Brian McVickers. Now, for our April Overland news, we go into some detail on the new Lexus GX 550, which is an incredibly exciting new model. We also talk about the Ford Ranger in the XLT variant with the FX4 package, and also the new Ranger Raptor. We also spent some time talking about a new motorcycle from Ducati. It is the Ducati Desert X Rally, which is one of the most incredible adventure motorcycles I've ever tested. And we spent some quality time with that in the Atlas Mountains and deserts of Morocco. Some additional conversation goes into new product from Ezion and some other new product coming on to the marketplace. So please enjoy our April Overland News with Brian McVickers.
And a special thanks to Kuat Racks for their support of this week's podcast. Their new Ibex has landed. In fact, it's overlanded. This groundbreaking bed rack effortlessly handles substantial loads both on and off the grid. It's constructed from lightweight yet durable aluminum, and it boasts a ballistic black powder coating that's made for all the nature you can throw at it. It's available in 7 different frame sizes, including the Gladiator now, to accommodate most truck models, and it's equipped with telescoping crossbars, numerous T-channels, and a versatile full and half-height configuration. It's the Ibex from Kuat, which they now have available the new Ibex panel kit. These panels easily mount to your existing Ibex frame, and they help to protect your gear from the elements. Plus, they're fully locking, offering security while still allowing quick access to the bed when you need it. It's going to be available later this summer, so visit kuat.com for more information. Thanks again, Kuat. All right, Brian.
Scott Brady, what's going on?
Man, it is good to be back in Prescott. It's good to be sitting across from my buddy.
You nearly got lost in Africa.
I got lost a few times. So
there's so many stories.
Yes, there is. There is. And this is actually my first podcast since returning to the U.S. A little bit ago. And we were able to successfully complete the crossing of Africa. And we ended at the Gulf of Aden, about 30 kilometers away from the shores of Yemen.
What was the total distance of the trip?
I would say probably drove around 21, 22,000 kilometers.
Okay. I was going to ask what was the total duration of the trip, but that's a little hard to answer because there were so many ups and downs and so many
challenges. A lot of just bureaucratic challenges, particularly getting into Ethiopia, that took some time. And then, you know, the last border didn't want to quite let us go, so we were actually detained at the Ethiopia-Djibouti border for 3 days. And we'll talk about that on a future podcast. But it was an incredible journey. I'm so humbled by the experience and by the incredible people of Africa and the people that I was able to travel with, from Joe in the first segment to Tavia in the second segment, and then Brian Bass for this last segment. And what was interesting to me was when Brian Bass and I drove up to the ocean and completed the crossing, there wasn't a single light on the dash. The Grenadier had never had a failure in the entire trip, which, given the fact that it's production unit number 372.
I was about to ask if it was, I couldn't remember if it was a pre-production or actual production.
It's not, well, it's, there's probably a little bit of both, but it's considered production.
Okay.
It's a production vehicle, but it would have been essentially very, very early on in that process.
Yeah.
So it was actually one of the media vehicles from the media launch. So this is a very, very early car.
It's been through a lot already.
It has. And actually, towards the end, I'm normally very, very careful with vehicles because I'm, but in this case, we were really trying to test this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never abusive to it, but I stopped saying no to a route.
I just went.
Yeah. I just, like, let's go check this out and let's go drive this 1,000 kilometers of corrugation just to see, because it just kept not having an issue. And I was expecting so early that there would be something that would come up. And to actually, after 6 months of travel and, you know, I don't know how many countries, but I'd have to calculate that out. But, you know, a lot of countries, a lot of miles of dirt, a lot of miles of really, really bad roads to end up at the other end of it without a single failure, I think is really promising. I'm certainly excited by the prospects of the brand. So
I know we're going to hear at a later date, we're going to hear more about
we'll do the
entirety of the trip. We'll but out of all the big expeditions that you've led and been a part of, not necessarily from the driving standpoint, I know there's a few expeditions and trips that you've done that, you know, building roads out of max tracks, that type of thing.
Sure.
Right. But from an overall difficulty standpoint, not difficulty, like I maybe from the adventurous side of difficulty.
Yeah.
Where would this Africa trip rank in everything that you did with Expedition 7, all the other continents that you've crossed?
Yeah, I was curious because the bureaucracy that we encountered around getting the vehicle into certain countries was certainly the most challenging that we've ever encountered. And some of it is the fact that this car has never been to these countries before. So it's not even in the system. So it causes this moment of the official going, what's going on here?
Yeah.
It's like gets out of the norm, which is what I primarily believe happened in Djibouti.
So when they look in their book and they see Land Cruiser 70 series, but they don't see Ineos Grenadier.
There is no Ineos Grenadier. Yeah. In fact, when I went into Mozambique, they had to like input it into the system. So it had never been in the system before. Now, Mozambique was very accommodating because they're used to tourists.
Yeah.
But a country like Djibouti is not used to getting tourists arriving overland. So it just made the official...
And do you think concerned. That was because the Ineos Grenadier is so new to the market, or do you think it could happen if you showed up in a Ford F-250 or an Earth Cruiser?
Yeah, something like that potentially. I mean, the advantage of the Earth Cruiser would be that most of them are built on a Fuso chassis,
which would be in their system.
But if you were to arrive in something obscure, like an Alfa Romeo Stelvio or whatever, like something like that, where it's just not even in the system.
Yeah.
And not only was the model not in the system, the manufacturer isn't even in the system.
Right.
So
it raises a lot of red flags.
Correct. But that will get resolved with time. So there'll be a second Grenadier in Ethiopia. There'll be a second Grenadier in Djibouti and it'll already be in the system. And I think a lot of it will have been resolved. But that was also part of the fun for me, was the challenge of getting this brand new vehicle through a continent.
So it was less of a test of equipment, but more of a test of patience.
although the vehicle tests were, because again, I started to really push the vehicle more so than I would normally do on a trip. Where I was looking for the most difficult routes.
You're gaining confidence.
Correct. Yeah. And I really wanted to push it. So I wanted our conclusions to reflect a lot of really abusive conditions. So like the deep mud we were in, the thousands and thousands of kilometers of corrugations, all of those things are very trying on a vehicle, particularly on a new vehicle. So it does show that kind of well of experience that is available in Graz, who they not only design the G-Wagon, but they also design the Grenadier. So a deep well of knowledge around making durable vehicles, because it's very hard to get that right out of the gate like they did. So, I mean, we'll do a full podcast on our experience with the Grenadier, the pros and the cons, the things that we encountered that were great and things that weren't so great. But it was just impressive to arrive, you know, 6 months later, 20-something thousand kilometers just in Africa, 25 and some change total on the vehicle, 26 maybe even thousand kilometers on the vehicle. And then we're now shipping it from Djibouti. It's got to go completely around the Horn of Africa back up to the Atlantic.
Thanks to the pirates and terrorists.
Yeah, that's right. So they're the Houthi rebels that are just right across the way are actively firing missiles and drones at ships, depending on how they're flagged. But they're even getting that wrong sometimes. So they're they're choosing to send most of the freight all the way around.
Which is going to add, it adds nearly 30 days to shipping.
Probably about 25, 26 days. So a lot of time to shipping. So it's got to go all the way around, then back into the Mediterranean, and then arrive in Greece. And then we're going to drive it through Greece, the eastern side of the Adriatic. So Macedonia, Albania,
Bosnia. That would have been a cool trip if you could have ridden along on the ship.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. That would have been amazing for sure. Yeah, so we're excited about the next segment. But we've got a series of videos, and we've also got a series of podcasts coming out on the trip itself. And for those that are listening, we also want to apologize. We missed a podcast in there due to some challenges with just connectivity in Africa. So we thank you all for your patience as we try not to miss more than about one or two podcasts a year. So we're still on that track, but we don't like to miss any at all, but we did miss one. So thank you all for sticking with us as we had some challenges getting those things into production, but we're back in the swing. So it's not a reflection on Paula at all. It's entirely a reflection on me for not getting that stuff up. So
quick question on connectivity during the trip, during your route through Africa, was the Starlink that you had with you were you ever in a place where you couldn't use it due to laws or?
Yes. Yes. And I didn't. And for that reason, I didn't bring it into Ethiopia or into Djibouti where they are not.
Oh, you didn't even have it with you.
I did not.
Okay.
And I also didn't bring, and I had it with me, and at the last minute, I chose to not bring in the Iridium that I had as well, which is an Iridium Go executive, which is a very suitable connectivity tool for this kind of travel. It's much smaller than a Starlink, and it doesn't have a lot of the vulnerabilities that Starlink does at the moment, because Starlink is being used in so many different theaters of operation that it's under constant attack. Whereas the Iridium network is very locked down. It is very commercial in nature. It's also very like NGO government in nature. Mm-hmm. So it's very robust around uptime.
And is that the same with drones? Did you have any drones?
Yeah, you cannot bring a drone into Ethiopia.
Okay.
I did not even look to see if you could bring a drone into Djibouti because...
And it's all regarded, even the communications tools are regarded as military equipment?
That's correct. They're generally viewed as military equipment. But then the secondary issue is that, you know, I was traveling through these places as a traveler. I'm not a like a traditional news style journalist.
Sure.
But you never want to give them the impression that you are there to like document some of the conflicts that are happening in northern Ethiopia or in certain areas of Djibouti. You're not allowed to be there as a journalist under those auspices. So it was just really important to me that I didn't even give the impression that I was there under those conditions. I was there as a tourist, and certainly will be covering it in content as a tourist, but which is permitted, but you don't want to give them any reason to believe that you're there because you have some political agenda.
Well, it's going to be really interesting how the advancement of this technology in use by overlanders who are out exploring the world, and they're not going to have the luxury of saying, well, we're going to stash it at this one country and then pick it up at the next country. It's just kind of, it's in the vehicle. How do you deal with that? And that's just going to get more and more.
Most of them are just
more of an issue as
well.
Time goes
most
on.
Of them are lucky at the moment because people don't really know what it is. So like we were never asked about the Starlink when we had it on the vehicle for Tanzania and for Kenya.
Okay.
And I mean, they didn't even know that it was there because it was up on the top of the vehicle, and it doesn't look like an antenna up on like a
rod. Flat.
It's flat mounted to the vehicle because of that unique componentry conversion. So it's totally under the radar, and most people are just traveling with the Starlink. Now, there are countries where you can just get in a whole bunch of trouble for that if you get caught. So I chose to go with limited communication,
yeah,
as opposed to the possibility of not achieving the objective of crossing the continent. So I think most travelers will probably be like, oh, sorry, we didn't know. And then the thing gets confiscated and maybe you got to pay a fine or whatever. Whereas I just wasn't willing.
You had an end goal in mind. Yeah,
I wasn't willing. And I felt comfortable with the tools that I had in place to be able to resolve those things. I did have a Garmin inReach with me for the entire trip, which would have allowed for us to have remote communications if the vehicle had had a significant issue.
Sure, and we've done that before quite a bit.
That's correct. But certain countries, even like India, and Garmin inReach is a controlled item. So you've got to really understand what you're up against on those things. And understand that there are shades of gray around some of these things. I just, on this trip, chose to not engage with any of those shades of gray.
Sounds like a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. But no, the Starlink is a game changer because you're going down the road in the middle of Africa, like in the Serengeti at 10 megabits a second while you're driving.
Crazy.
So it's an incredible tool, and it gives you a lot of confidence with these newer, more complicated vehicles because you can plug in a workbook into it and you can clear codes, you can download updates, you can do all of those things if you had to, which is why we had that stuff along with us. But fortunately, we didn't need to do it.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So Africa was amazing. We're excited to share more about that in the future. But and then I also was able to interview Kingsley Holgate while I was in South Africa. And he's just an incredible individual. So for those that are listening, please look for the Kingsley Holgate interview coming out in the next couple weeks, which is one of the most incredible interviews I've ever done in 20 years of being in this business. So he's an absolute gem saint. So that was very, very cool. I'm looking forward to that. And then when I was in South Africa, I was able to spend some time testing some new Ezion products. So they have a new Galaxy tent. They've got some really interesting new products that they've brought on to the market recently that I think are going to appeal to a wider audience. Ezion products have always just been very like expedition, long-term overlanding focused kinds of products, things that you will to your net to the next generation.
Or they last a long time. Was that when you were in Johannesburg?
That's right. Yeah. So I was able to drive a 300 series Land Cruiser with a diesel. I've driven the 300 before, but in the gas variant. So it was nice to spend time with the 300 in a diesel and, you know, days behind the wheel of, you know, in the backcountry and everything else like that. And I really liked this new Galaxy tent. They also have one, I believe it's called
the Saber
or something along those lines. It's a smaller tent for like a four-door pickup with a short bed. So I had it on a Hilux and it fits on that small bed.
Okay.
And it pops up one direction and then it folds out with a ladder and everything, like more of a traditional soft-sided tent, but it's a hard shell aluminum tent. That actually really works.
Do you have
well.
It mounted down low below the cab?
No, that would be good. But no, I rented a vehicle from a company called Overlanding with Bruce, and he has a small fleet of Hilux.
Fully outfitted with everything.
They are ready to go.
Cool.
Including some campers and stuff like that are really sweet, like Alucab stuff. But then they also have Ezion roof tents. And I really like that small format roof tent. It was very cool. But so was the Galaxy. The Galaxy was roomy, tons of headroom, huge open door. But then we got caught in a storm and it did fine.
Nice.
Like I was in it while it was raining and blowing and everything else. And it has a lot of surface area, but it did fine. So that was cool. So some nice new stuff from Ezion that are worth checking out. Nice to see such a long standing company continuing to innovate. So
they've got to be 40, 50 years now.
Yeah, I think they're over 40 years. Yeah. Yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, pretty cool. So you, right before or right as I was leaving, or maybe even a week or a couple of days after I left.
Early January.
Yeah. You went and participated in the launch of the new Lexus GX 550.
They did a first drive event down in Tucson. Arizona.
That was convenient.
Really convenient. We just drove down, which is cool. I was at SHOT Show for a few days. Did SHOT Show, I think, for Monday, Tuesday, and then drove over to Tucson and then drove the Lexus for Wednesday through Friday. It was neat. They had all the different trim levels there. We were really more focused on the over trail.
Man, it is just...
They have six different versions of that vehicle.
It's so cool because Lexus has always made, or almost always had available, a pinnacle vehicle for overland travel. They just never really knew what they had. I mean, they did, but they didn't really market it in that way.
Yeah.
And that goes all the way back to the original 80 series that was rebranded as an LX. And then, of course,
the original 80 series was rebranded?
It was. For the last couple of years, you could get a LX, I believe it was a 450. My sincere apologies to all that are listening that if I get that wrong, but
you know, there's yeah. the guys who are like twitching. Right now. Yeah, they know.
So I think I got that right. And it had a straight six. It was just like the 80 series, but it had some, you know, a little bit more luxurious trimmings, and it had the Lexus badge on the front. So they started all the way back then with solid axle.
The early Lexus that version looks a lot more like an 80 series.
That's right. And then they had a 100 series based LX, and then they had a 200 series based LX, and then they even have the new LX 600, which is based on the 300 series. So it's the only variant of the 300 series Land Cruiser that we get is the current Lexus model, at least for the time being. So to see them come out with this GX 550 over trail is no question, and from what I've heard from the folks at Lexus, they see the opportunity of the overland audience because they buy new vehicles, they're adventure-minded, they do like some comfort because of the road trip nature of travel by vehicle. So Lexus is a perfect fit.
And you can see, if you look at the last 3 years, right? So two SEMAs ago, so it would have been 2022, they had all their new Lexus vehicles, but when you listen to their team talk about the new vehicles, they talked a lot about overlanding, they talked a lot about adventure, luxurious adventure.
Yep.
It was part of their vocabulary.
Yeah.
Fast forward to 2023 SEMA. That's a big booth. If you remember this, it's got to be 200 by 50 or something.
Sure.
You know, it's a big booth for SEMA. And they had they had three vehicle positions that were dedicated to user builds.
Wow.
So they brought in three general consumers who had older model Lexuses and had built them into overlanding.
Is that a Lexi?
A Lexi, yeah. Lexuses. And there were, I can't remember all the models, but there were different years and different models, but there was one that was, you know, completely lifted. I think it was on 37-inch mud tires.
Sweet.
And then there was another one that was owned by, just a couple who was out traveling. And then there was one that was owned by a single individual guy who was out traveling. But it showed me that they were really embracing the end user.
Yeah.
Of how people were using these vehicles for adventure.
Yeah, so you see it at the Overland Expos with the Lexus vehicles there. You see it at SEMA with the Lexus vehicles that are very much intended for overlanding and for travel. They've got Kurt Williams involved.
He does a lot of training for the team.
Yeah, yeah. So like if Kurt Williams is involved at the corporate level with Lexus around overlanding, I mean, they're clearly committed because Kurt is one of the best folks that I can think of to do that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is the training that Kurt's been doing, as far as what I understand, is he has been training the staff at a lot of different levels, from engineering to vehicle design and marketing and PR, about what adventurous travel with the vehicle entails.
Right.
And he's even had them out driving the vehicles. And I was talking with him about one event, and he had people who had never driven the vehicles off-road.
Sure.
And he was, they're, you know, engaging low range, and they're going through these obstacles, and people had no idea what these vehicles could do, but they work on them every day in some capacity.
Yeah,
so it's really valuable for that team.
It's very clear that, and I hope that the LX600 receives the same kind of treatments at some point, but it is very clear that the 550 Overtrail is them going all in, which we heard from Toyota marketing years ago. They were going all in on overlanding.
Yeah.
And you can see that they built a vehicle that is going to be incredibly popular.
Yeah, I think, you know, so we got the chance to drive it really for 2 days. The first day we drove it primarily on the road. And
how did that go? Did it, like, because it's got a lot of off-road hardware, including some fairly aggressive all-terrain tires.
It does.
Pretty upright windscreen.
It was very stable.
Yeah.
It has a really confident footprint.
Yeah.
So when you're, you know, it was quick off the line. It was easy to stop. It didn't have any, I didn't notice any wallow.
Yeah.
It's a big, heavy truck.
Sure.
And maybe that's part of just the advancement in, you know, electronic and valving suspension and kind of the new advancements. But like,
yeah,
you get into an older Lexus or an older Land Cruiser and you flick the wheel around and you kind of feel this wallow from side to side, even
sure.
with a stock suspension.
Sure.
And this didn't have any of that. So it was very sure-footed.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, the fact that it has now a rear locking differential, which is a first
mm-hmm.
for a Lexus product, other than it may have been the first LX and the second LX had at least a rear locker available. The first LX could have gotten a front and rear locker. But the fact that it has a rear locking differential, center locking differential, advanced traction control, which is going to be even better than the A-Track that we know from a couple years ago. I mean, this thing's going to be very capable on the trail. And it looks like it just has good angles and clearance overall.
Yeah, so you can see all the corners very easily. You can see over the hood quite well.
Yeah, nice.
The one of the things I liked about the hood was that it's a pretty sheer 90 degree angle at the
yeah.
front. So, you know, I've never really liked some of the older Lexus models that had kind of that pointy hood.
Yeah, sure.
With the grill that like looked like it went on forever,
yep.
right? And with this new, just hard angled grill and front end, you can go right up to something and feel like you know where the bumper is.
Sure.
And the bumper doesn't stick out, so the front of the vehicle's flat.
And it looks like it's just ready for the aftermarket.
It is.
Like
yeah.
they really set it up to be supported by the aftermarket.
They did, and I asked them about that because it's not going to come with a winch. They don't have a provision from the factory for a winch. But when you look at the front grill, when you look at the front area, there's a skid plate, at least on the Overtrail Plus and the Overtrail as well. There's a skid plate that is incorporated up into the grill area. And so you can remove that skid plate. And then from the looks of it, because there's a seam that runs just below all the sensors, it looks like you can remove the lower portion of the bumper.
The fascia, sure.
The fascia, yeah, it's not
yeah.
even really a bumper,
yep.
right? So you can remove that lower portion, and then you should be able to bolt on some sort of an aftermarket bumper solution. That could accommodate a winch.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that they're going to crush it with this vehicle. Because it's going to be, Toyota sells so many 4Runners.
Yeah.
But they never really had like the luxurious version of the TRD or the TRD Pro.
This thing is nothing but luxury.
Yeah, exactly. So you get like this very comfortable vehicle, drive back and forth to work every day.
Yeah.
You're going to have the experience of buying the vehicle from a Lexus dealership, which has the highest customer satisfaction of any dealerships. So you just have this overall luxurious engagement with the manufacturer, but you can still go do Hell's Revenge and Moab.
Yeah. So you get into the vehicle and it's all leather. It's voluminous on the inside. It's really big, but it doesn't feel, you know, sometimes a big truck is going to feel oversized.
Yeah. Or maybe bulbous. You know? Whereas this just seems taller. Like it's got more headroom and more overall height.
But you can lean over from the driver's seat and get the other door.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Whereas, you know, some vehicles, you think of like a big, you know, a big full size pickup truck, you got to undo your seatbelt and crawl over to get the door. Right.
Right.
But then besides that, it's really big user interface screens, very comfortable seating position, heated and cooled seats, massaging seats.
Oh, wow.
I think they had five different massage modes on both front seats. So that was amazing. And everything about it was comfortable.
Yeah.
And when you, over the past couple of years, you drive a lot of these vehicles and it's a lot of these things are, for better or for worse, they're to be expected.
Yeah.
Right. And so some of these vehicles you get in and you're like, you're trying to be impressed because a lot of the things are, well, yeah, of course we have that technology. Of course this vehicle should be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This one felt, it kind of had this, I mean, I don't want to overuse the word luxury, but it had this really nice feeling to it.
Quality probably more even than luxury.
You know, where you got in it, you were proud to be driving it.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of had this smile on your face.
Yeah.
And then knowing that you could, you know, get off the pavement, go explore the desert all day or the mountains or whatever it might be, it has this extra level of confidence for such a vehicle.
Yeah, huge breadth of capability. I'm super excited about the Lexus, the GX. I think they're going to crush it with that. I can't wait to see what the aftermarket does with it. It's fairly priced, given modern vehicle pricing.
Yeah.
So it's just going to be really cool to see how it comes together.
I think personally as a buyer, I'd be cautious with the aftermarket. It didn't feel like it needed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it has, it would be easy to put a roof rack on it. It would be nice to have a winch, for, you know, just for that extra safety factor.
Yeah, for sure.
But
for people that travel solo,
you know, I wouldn't mess with the suspension. I wouldn't try to stick a bigger tire on it, you know, within means. I think you could probably put maybe one size up pretty easily.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't just start chopping on them. I mean, the amount of technology and the amount of engineering that's gone into this vehicle is so impressive that I just use it as long as you could.
Buy it and go.
Yeah. Cause you're not, the truck's going to outdrive you.
Yeah.
You're not going to find its limitations on a regular basis.
Sure.
Right. If you're finding the limitations of that vehicle on a regular basis, it might not be the vehicle that you need.
Yeah. Or, for vehicle based travel, it's going to do everything you want it to do.
The cargo area is huge.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, that's going to be fun to see.
And we opened it up and we just started throwing gear in it just to see how it would kind of
swallow
everything.
All of it,
and we had two backpacks and a Pelican case and tripods, and it just kind of kept on taking gear. And then we stepped back and look at it. It was only half full.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, so it was nice.
Yeah, very exciting new vehicle. Nice job, Lexus, on that. When I left about the same time as you did, I was going to Morocco to ride the new Ducati Desert X Rally.
That looks like an awfully nice bike.
It is. The biggest problem that everyone who's tested this bike has is not coming across as a total fanboy or fangirl.
Right.
Because it's that good. Ducati clearly spent a lot of energy making this bike exceptional. And I think that they weren't afraid to try some new things that we haven't seen in that class of motorcycle up until this point. That kind of midweight motorcycle they've always been intentionally constrained because they had bigger bikes on their menu. So like the BMW 800 GS or 850 was kind of, it was always okay. But because they put so much energy and emphasis on the 1250.
Yeah, 800 and 850 were kind of a stopgap. It was a filler.
Yeah, it just filled in the lineup.
Yeah.
But it never, it's like they intentionally held them back so that someone would have a reason to buy the.
Oh, so they're not cannibalizing the
1200
bikes.
Or the 1250, right? Whereas it looks to me like Ducati didn't even think about the fact that they have the Multistrada, Which they do have it in some variants that can go off-road, but it's never been an off-road bike. It's always been a touring bike mm-hmm. that can do some dirt. So they just unshackled the engineers and the marketing team around the Desert X, and they built, I think, one of the best adventure bikes that I've ever ridden.
Does it have all the functionality that they added to the bike? Are they things that you are happy that they brought to the bike, or yeah. did they just kind of fill it with a bunch of random functionality and farkles that
it doesn't feel like that at all.
That useful.
It doesn't feel like that at all. Whereas like on the Multistrada, it has radar cruise control, which it's somewhat interesting. It would probably help you on really long trips.
Yeah.
But like, no, the Desert X Rally doesn't have anything that you don't need. In fact, they took the time to engineer an auxiliary fuel tank for it.
Oh, that's great.
That goes underneath the rear seat, and it adds another 1.8 gallons of fuel to the 5.5 or 5.4.
So they really built it for the rider.
They built it for doing big trips. I mean, they really did. And it has 110 horsepower, which if you think about it, not that long ago, a BMW 1200 had less horsepower than that. So this is a bike that weighs 465 pounds, so over 100 pounds lighter than a GS 1200. It has the same horsepower as a GS from a few years ago. And the reality is that off-road, most bikes, when you go into an off-road mode, they pull back the horsepower to about 100 anyways.
Yeah.
And like if you look at the KTM 950 that you and I ride, that is a 100 horsepower dirt bike.
Right.
So 100 horsepower in an adventure bike is about perfect for the dirt. Anything more than that and you're just asking for it.
It's too fast.
And it's also just, it's hard to control it because riding on the dirt does require a lot of modulation and a lot of control. So the Desert X Rally, it's got 110 horsepower. It does throttle it back in some of the off-road modes. You can also open it up.
Can you override?
Oh yeah. And that's the thing about it, because the Italians don't care. So you can shut off every safety feature that you choose on the bike.
Brilliant.
Yeah, you can just go into full like bug splatter mode. Yeah. You can do that, and it's incredible off road. It's incredibly forgiving. It has some of the best turning stability and grip that we've experienced on any of the bigger bikes, and a lot of that is because of the way that it's built around weight distribution, and also that it's very lightweight.
So the only images that I've seen of that bike test of you riding that bike, you're either sideways or you're in the air.
Yeah. And it kind of wanted you to do that. Like the bike felt very, very confident, inspiring around that. And, you know, literally the only thing that was the limitation on that test for me is I brought the wrong helmet. It was very, very dusty. So I just needed to give a lot of space around the dust because I didn't have a off-road helmet with goggles. That was my mistake. And then interestingly, I mean, we were riding so hard. I had not been riding that much before that. So I was hitting the limits of my fitness, my cardiovascular fitness, around that much riding at those speeds for that length of time. So like, fortunately I didn't drop the bike. I didn't get stuck. I didn't have any issues, but I was very much cognizant of the fact that I wasn't in riding shape.
But that's something that I think not a lot of people think about.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of these, you know, adventure bikes that are totally overloaded. You know that when they're out, they're not pushing it that hard.
Yeah. But
the fact that you can push these bikes that hard and that it does become a physical workout. It's
big time. And the terrain that we were riding was technical enough that you were in it. Like you were really pushing yourself.
Well, they say motocross racing is one of the most physically demanding sports.
Right. Yeah. So now you make it a 465 pound bike and you really start to press yourself, which was great. It was good for me to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
I hadn't been riding in a little while because of things that were going on, but it inspired me to get back on the bike and make sure that I'm always in riding shape.
Well, and you know not to push your limits and you find your limits.
Well, in this case, if you don't push, you don't keep up. So I was pinging. Like my Garmin watch was like, Try not to kill yourself. I was sitting at like 150 to 165 beats per minute for like hours at a time.
Mine told me the other day that I was overtraining.
It gets very judgmental at times. Yeah, exactly. So, the bike is incredible. Ducati should be really proud of the motorcycle. I think that for most travelers, the rally is going to be more than what they need, and they should consider the standard Desert X. It's a lower seat height. It's quite a bit less expensive. One of the things that I found interesting was that they included everything for heated grips, including the button. They just didn't have the heating elements in the grips.
Okay.
And that, I think that that's a mistake when manufacturers do that, because it's such an expensive motorcycle for what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of content, but I think that you're better off just providing the customer with the heated grips, because it's a rounding error in the motorcycle.
And you know it's done right. You know, people try to do it themselves or take it into the shop and pay a couple hundred bucks to have it done.
Yeah, especially when there's the button right there.
Yeah.
That's going to make people be like, seriously? So that was one of the things. The seat height is actually quite high. So I'm 6'1", and the bike felt comfortable to me. It's kind of about the same height as the 950 KTM, but that can be a very tall bike. And so you're talking about a 36-inch-ish seat height. So it's a tall motorcycle. Mm-hmm. So it's going to inherently restrict some people from being able to ride it, unless they're very experienced.
Does that base model come with, will it accept the auxiliary tank?
It will. And it has a low fender. It has a little less suspension travel, and it's a lower motorcycle as well. So there are some advantages to that. It uses an Olin suspension, whereas the Rally uses a KYB suspension system, mm-hmm. which is just like, it's over the top. I mean, it's 9.8 inches of suspension in the front and 9.4 in the rear. So
awesome.
Like you're rallying the thing, and it's just, it is an awesome motorcycle. And I would say that it is most likely the motorcycle I would buy for my own use. Although the Triumph 1200 Scrambler XE would be a close second.
It's a different bike though.
Yeah.
You'd get it for different reasons.
Maybe. But those would be the two that I would be deciding between.
Yeah.
So I think either one I'd be super happy with. But I think for long distance travel, the Ducati would be a better choice because of the fuel tank size.
Do they have factory luggage solutions?
Everything you need.
Okay.
They literally have everything for this bike to ride it around the world.
And what is the price point range?
Yeah, so they are going to range into the low 20s. So it's a fairly expensive motorcycle by the time you get it all upfitted. So
really competing with the BMW.
Yeah. And it's going to just run circles around it. Look, I mean, not to take anything away from a 1250 or anything, but like just, yeah. Anyways, nice. It's an awesome bike. Yeah. Awesome bike. We also started a new project vehicle based upon the Wrangler 4xe, and we worked with Real Truck on that. And this is my first time working with them and just kind of ordering. I was just really impressed with the degree of communication that we received. Mm-hmm. I have always just kind of been like, if I have a Jeep, I'm going to put AEV on it and be done with it. But in this case, I went with a different kind of lift because I wanted to try something new. So I went with a super lift. It's got Fox shocks. The ride quality is excellent. I did end up, though, still going with AEV brackets because AEV just does one of the best jobs in the industry of making sure that the geometry is figured out. So, and it also lowers the roll center with the rear drag link and a rear panhard rod. So it makes a huge difference on roll center with the realignment bracket.
Were those bolt on or weld?
They're bolt on.
Okay.
They're all bolt on. The whole kit is bolt on. But I'm a real fan of the whole 4xe program from Jeep because I can plug the thing in and every possible errand you could do in Prescott, you can do it all on electric mode.
Okay.
But you got 35-inch tires.
So it's got 26, 27 miles of range from what I remember.
Yeah, much less than that now because of the larger tires. So probably 21, 22.
Yeah, but still great for around town.
It's enough for around town. And But then you can keep the fuel tank full. And if you're like, ah, I got to run down to Phoenix real quick, you can just go do a long road trip. So I'm really impressed with the JL. You've had yours for a long time, but this is my first time really being able to spend time in the JL. And I like that 4xE program that they got going on.
So I've got the 2018 and I had to grow into it a little bit. I think when I first got it, we had, you know, with having two teenagers who are, you know, size of adults or tall.
Yeah.
When they were both in house, it was tight.
Yeah.
You were really like finding every little nook and cranny for storage.
Yeah.
Now that they're, you know, one's out of the house in college and one's driving on his own most of the part, it's kind of like at the most we have three people in it. It's a little bit easier to manage. We also, we put a box up on top that we use quite a bit. For two people, it's great.
Yeah.
But they've always been a little bit smaller on the inside than I was originally expecting. But I spent quite a bit of time in the 4xE last summer.
That's right. You've spent some time driving them. Both the Grand Cherokee and the Wrangler you've driven.
Grand Cherokee was probably my favorite 4xE that I've driven so far.
Yeah. If I didn't do this stuff for a living and I just needed a super cool car to drive back and forth to work and go hiking and go and tow a trailer and everything else, like it's unbelievable how good that Grand Cherokee is.
The Wrangler was really nice in when you're out on the trail to be able to go over to electric mode only.
Totally.
Super quiet, roll all the windows down. And it was a different experience out in the forest. It was really neat.
Yeah. So here's a hack around that. So when you know you're going to go drive off highway, take it out of hybrid mode and put it into what's called e-save, e-save mode. And then that, other than if you have a really heavy acceleration event or whatever, it is constantly topping off the battery and not using electric to improve miles per gallon. That way, when you get to the trail, you now have 20 miles approximately.
But you've got a full battery.
You got a full battery for, and it's so nice to drive off highway in an EV. I say it's much better.
Yeah.
Like I don't need to announce that I'm like, you know, have open pipes or whatever. Like I like the car to be super quiet.
Well, I had it on a trail and the guy in front of me had a Porsche Cayenne that he had, you know, kind of off-roaded, right? Oh, completely modified. And it was all brappy. And we were past, it was a multi-use trail with hikers on it.
Yeah.
And they would all like scramble to the side of the trail and move over as they heard this guy coming.
Right.
And then they'd get back on the trail and then they didn't even hear me coming. And they were surprised to see the Jeep come around the corner. And so, and then they were really friendly. It was a nice interaction with folks.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why I'm out there in nature is to experience nature and also have more interactions with animals because the vehicle is so quiet. You see a lot more animals. They're not scared off by it. So the 4xE is a win for me. And it's been fun to work on that project. We put the Nitto tires on there, the Grappler tires. And they're very, very quiet on the road, but they have a really aggressive kind of outer lug segment and a lug that wraps around the sidewall. So they're quiet on the road. They do fairly well in the wet, but then they also have a more aggressive side lug for climbing up rocks for that mechanical keying or for clearance of mud and snow. If you need some, if you're getting your tread packed. So it's really kind of a nice hybrid. Between an all, it's like a mild all terrain in the center of it, but then a little more aggressive all terrain on the shoulders.
And it's nice to see another manufacturer coming out with really thoughtful tire design.
Yeah. And Nitto's known for making really bomber tires. So they're known to be super durable. They've always been known to be durable. Now they've got some more advanced tread patterns. So they're really coming into their own. So that's been cool to mount those tires up and really test those out. We'll have a full report on those soon.
And that wasn't a knock on those Porsche Cayennes. They're pretty cool. When they're off-roaded. I actually started looking for a used one after driving around with that guy.
Yeah. The challenge that people have with the Cayennes is that they see like, oh, this car is $18,000, but you're actually buying a $120,000 car.
Right.
So you're going to have the maintenance and service of a $120,000 vehicle.
Yeah, it's not free by any means.
It is the furthest thing from free.
And a special thanks to O3 Outdoors for their support of this week's podcast. The world is messy. That's the price every outdoorsman pays for adventure. So when we need to keep things fresh, well, we at O3 Outdoors don't just do things halfway. We turn to the same technology NASA uses to clean the space station, and we bring it down to our own frontier. You know the smells, the sweat, smoke, and fuel, the smells of a proper adventure. The stuff of a true outdoorsman knows firsthand. Our technology here at O3 Outdoors eliminates bacteria and odors on gear or in your homes and on your vehicles. Our Trekker bags allow you to pack, store, and carry your gear, cleaning it the entire time. Our portable Overlander units fit in any vehicle, home, or RV. It's the highest tech, brought to you to the outdoor experience, keeping your gear fresh from one frontier to another. For more information, visit o-3outdoors.com. O3 Outdoors, go explore.
Well, so tell me about your experience with the new Ranger, because I'm super...
It's ridiculous.
Super interested in that.
It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it and that was the Ranger Raptor part of it. So wasn't it like the Assault or something like that?
The Assault School, yeah. Which I don't like the name. I think it's a horrible name for the school, but it's a cool school.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, to back up real quick, I spent 2 days with Ford and the Ranger program. And the first day was the XL, the XLT, and the Lariat. And that was all on road. And it was good. What made it interesting is we were up in the mountains of Utah and we got hit by a snowstorm on the same day. So it just added a lot to the experience of, I mean, we've all been on these drives and you go drive around in the mountains on the pavement and it's okay. But now when you've got,
it became an adventure.
You know, it was 100 feet of visibility and ultimately I'm driving in 12 inches of snow. And
that's happened to you twice now in Utah when you went on a vehicle launch.
Utah is terribly unpredictable.
Yeah. Cause you were on a Range Rover launch and like had 100-foot.
Oh my God. We had 28 inches of snow in 12 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
That was pretty cool. So,
the one package that I think is interesting, the one package I think that's the most interesting is the FX4.
So the XLT with the FX4 that's package.
Right. Yeah.
I would say, I'd say that's the most for overlanding and vehicle travel where you've got a really good vehicle that you can use on the day-to-day.
Rear locking differential, yep. Upgraded shocks, larger diameter tires, some skid plates, but you can still get it into that 1,600 pounds of payload.
Right. So it's
awesome.
It's that everyday vehicle you can go adventure in. You know, you might even be able to get away with a very small, lightweight camper type mm-hmm. situation on the back.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's got the best payload. I mean, it's on par with a Gladiator for payload. And it can be the Ranger and the Gladiator can sometimes be 30 or 40% higher payload than the competition. And no one else is really that close. So to get the FX4 package where you've got rear locker, you got some off-road chops with it, but then you can still get into that 1,600 or so pounds of payload. I mean, that's a real win because that's not just a go-fast camper. You could put a four-wheel camper in the back of that thing.
And they're tiny.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, the dimensions are tiny, so
they're not an over bloated midsize for sure.
You know, the fender, you know, the sides are fairly sheer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, like we were talking about with the Lexus on the angles, it's fairly sheer on all four sides.
Yeah.
So it was easy to identify your corners and your, you know, the front and back limits.
And I think it's because it's for an international market. You go, I mean, it's one of the most popular trucks now in Australia. It's finally outbeat the Hilux.
So I was talking to ARB a couple of weeks ago and they said that in the Australian market, the Ranger has outsold the Hilux.
Yeah. Which is unbelievable.
Now granted, it's, last year, it outsold them by like 354 units.
Well, still.
But they'll take it, right?
Still. I'm sure they worked really hard to make sure that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I can imagine if they were like under by three or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it's the Ranger, it's a very legitimate vehicle. The other thing that I like about the Ranger is it's a very honest truck. It's not trying to be something that it's not.
Yeah.
You can get it in a couple different cab configurations, which is hard to find. So I'm really excited to see the updates that they've had. And now the Raptor, the Ranger Raptor.
So the Raptor is a totally different vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a different chassis. It's a wider footprint by, I think, 3.5 inches.
Sure.
Different suspension, different engine, different, everything about it is different.
400 horsepower, right?
Yeah.
Something like
405.
So I think it's the same engine that's in the Bronco Raptor.
It's the 3 liter.
Or 3.5, something like
that.
Yeah. Yes. Either one. Yeah.
But it is. It's the same one as the Bronco.
10 speed automatic.
So that thing is, it's fast and it's quick. And then when you combine that with the footprint, it was, when we did, so we took that for a full day of just nothing but, you know, four-wheel drive. And they take you to, so if you buy a Ranger Raptor or any of the Raptors, if you buy a Bronco Raptor or an F-150 Raptor, as part of the price of the truck, you get a day at a Raptor assault school. And so if you buy the Ranger Raptor, you have to get yourself there, but once you're there, you get treated to the Ford Performance Racing School, and the Raptor part of that is the assault school. So it's just outside of Salt Lake City, a big, nice new facility connected to a warehouse full of trucks and mm-hmm. vehicles. You get in the vehicles there, you drive about 30 minutes on the pavement, which is nice because now you get to get the feel for the vehicle, you get to go through all the drive modes, and then they take you to this piece of private property that has 3 different driving courses and then probably 4 or 5 kind of dedicated skill development demonstrations, right? And then across the road from that, there's a big piece of BLM land that they have access to use for basically it's a steep climb, sharp rock crawling, and then a really steep descent. And so you really get to go through all the drive modes and you get to see what this vehicle can do. And so I would say that the Ranger Raptor is enough of a different vehicle that if you do buy it, you go to this school, they teach you about all the functionality and capability, and then they've got really enthusiastic instructors. They want you to drive these vehicles. They want you to learn how to drive them. And so you get to push the vehicle in a different, it's in a controlled environment,
That's the key, because I think one of the reasons that prompted that was the number of Raptors that were getting wrapped around a pole or sure. wrapped around a tree, because people start writing checks that their experience has no business trying to cash.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to, it's, so there was one course that it's their Baja course. It has, I don't know the distance. I don't know how long the track is distance-wise, but it was 13 turns.
Hmm.
And I found, at least on my, what I found is that you're going from one turn to the next and the next, and you kind of forget that there's another turn.
Hmm.
You forget you're just into it.
Yeah.
And there's just so much going on, and the vehicle is doing everything that you want it to.
Sure.
So you're really keeping up with the vehicle. The vehicle's not trying to keep up with you.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Which was a lot of fun. And it was neat because, yeah, you get to throw the truck sideways and you
got to even jump it a little bit. Yeah.
We did. We got to jump it. And there were two jumps. There was one that was a dedicated jump. And you get set up and you put it into manual mode and second gear and low range. And you floor it. And you start at a cone. You floor it. And then you just stay on it until you're airborne, and then you let off the throttle, and then it lands and you brake. So it was a very controlled jump.
Yeah, sure.
The other one was on the Baja course. It's actually a dip. Huh. So it's a big suspension dip where I don't know if you bottom out or not.
Yeah.
But if you do bottom out, you don't know. It absorbs it so well.
Yeah.
But we had a couple of runs I had. It was me and 2 other people in the car, and we would go. They just say go as fast as you want. So it was at the very last run out after you're done with all the turns. And you would kind of, aerate off of it, and then you'd squish, right?
Sure.
But then my last run, I was all by myself. And so you get a little bit lighter vehicle, you know, take a couple hundred pounds out. And it's also like the last run, you know, you can go a little bit faster.
And it's always the last run that gets you.
I'm pretty sure I aired that thing out. It went up in the air and it landed and you wouldn't even know the difference. The suspension modulation is so good that when it did land, it kept tracking without any additional effort.
Yeah.
So
the damping is just really excellent.
Yeah. And it's an active valve system. It's got five or six different drive modes.
Cool.
So it really makes a difference and you can feel it. Sometimes you get in a vehicle and you go through all the different modes and you're kind of like, I don't understand what the difference is. This one is pretty noticeable.
I'm pretty excited about the addition of this vehicle. Obviously the payload's down a little bit because of all the other hardware and kind of how they set it up. Mm-hmm. It's set up where the spring rates are set up to be optimized for high performance as opposed to load capacity like you would have in an XLT.
Right. So the towing capacity is a little bit lower.
That's right.
Yeah.
But in 2020, I actually drove a Ford Ranger Raptor in South Africa, and it was so impressive. And I thought, oh, I sure hope that they bring that to the United States.
Yeah.
So it's very cool to see it become available. And what I remember about that vehicle was how capable it was even in low-speed technical terrain because of the size of the tires, the locking differential, the suspension travel is so long.
And you can put it wherever you want. Mm. I mean, you can really hunt around the track to find your line.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Whereas if you're in a big full-size truck, you're just kind of there. And you just, you know, there's only one path to take. Whereas this thing, you know, you could probably fit two of them side by side on a lot of trails.
How fun, man.
And so you can really pick around rocks and pick your line. It was a nice driving vehicle. That said, I think it's become a really competitive category. You know, if you look at the past year, like I would.
Yeah, the new stuff from Chevrolet on 35s.
GMC.
Exactly.
You look at that, you know, the Colorado, the.
Mm-hmm.
Was it
the Canyon AT4X? Yeah.
Yeah. And all that stuff from AEV.
Yeah.
And the 35s from the factory.
Yeah.
That's
insane.
That, like, I think for a lot of like, if you're not out there kind of just trying to go fast all the time, I think that would be the solution.
Yeah. Cause then you end up with just a massive tire.
Right.
Like, you literally don't have to modify it anymore.
Yeah. You don't touch it.
Yeah, you don't have to touch it. Yeah, what an exciting time in our industry, you know, to have the new Overtrail Lexus GX, to have the new Ranger, you know, to have the Grenadier, to have all of these vehicles coming out, the new Land Cruiser, new 4Runner is imminent, you know, the new Toyota that we've got. I mean, just all of the new stuff that's coming out. If you look at the new Tacoma, for example, or the new Tacoma Trail Hunter, I mean, there's just a lot of new stuff coming out into the market that I think is really exciting. And from every manufacturer, like we just talked about with GMC and with Chevrolet. So across the board, everybody's really doing a good job of building these overland vehicles. So it's never been a better time if you're in the market for a new vehicle than now.
Yeah, there's a lot of choices and, you know, go on as many test drives as you can.
Yeah, go check them out.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it does, I found that after driving all these different vehicles, it does come down to a lot of personal preference.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They can all do what you want. They can all do more than you want.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, trim packages and what you need, what you don't need.
Yeah, and if you like how it looks or whatever, or, you know, where it's got the aftermarket support that you want, you know, like, if you look at like a Gladiator Rubicon, it's going to have a totally different degree of capability than you would get in a Ranger Raptor. So it's pretty exciting to see the breadth of options on the market right now.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll get back together soon because there's still lots and lots to talk about.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Lots of new things coming onto the market. We'll try to make sure we're doing these once every month or so we can keep abreast of all of the new product coming onto the market. But
we're coming into event season. So that's
right.
The next
thing. Overland Expo will be coming up and everything else.
A lot of new events this year.
That's right. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Excellent, Brian. Well, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Scott.
And we thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.